So here's a story. A couple of months back, I had a follower reach out to me who said, why don't you interview somebody who's known to us and our surroundings? Perhaps somebody at a five-star hotel working behind the scenes. We want to know what happens there. And it was great feedback, right? And I took it and I remember catching onto it and saying, I wish I can make that happen. And happen it did when I met Chris Olivier, who's speaking to me on this episode of Karishma Connect, multi-property beverage manager and sommelier at St. Regis Dubai. Chris speaks to me about all things hospitality. He shares tips for budding aspirants. He also tells me more about why there's much more to food and beverage than what meets the eye and some of the wines that you need to try out and a whole lot more. So go check out the interview. It's super exciting. I've been waiting to share it with y'all. And if you've got more such exciting stories to share, please do connect with me. And until the next one, stay tuned. I'll be back very, very, very soon. Until then, tada.
Thank you so much, Chris, for joining me on this episode of Karishma Connect. Like I said, I've been waiting for this one because it was very much a listener request as well, that somebody told me that, why don't you do an episode with somebody who's more relatable, you know, from one of the hotels that we go to and we understand what's going on behind the scenes. And put it out there. Yeah. I said, I hope I meet someone and here you are. So thank you so much for being that someone. It means a lot. Thank you.
No, but thank you for having me. And thank you for your patience. It's just been, look, it's been a busy few weeks. And I think when you first texted me the first time, I was like, oh my gosh, I need to make time for this. But I will do it. But when and where was the key part on how we were going to get this over the line. So, but thank you. It's really cool to be here. Awesome.
Great. The first question I ask, Chris, to anyone is because you yes. say your journey best, and I truly believe that. So I will leave it to you to tell me your journey so far. Get right in. Tell me the details because I need people yeah. to know how you kind of arrived at where you are today and all that went into making that yeah. happen.
Oof. I've actually, I started in hospitality out of necessity. I actually grew up in a house with a single parent. And both me and my brothers were very young, growing teenagers. And my mom said to me, look, you know, we were always asking for pocket money and stuff. And she was like, well, if you want pocket money, you have to go work for it. So both me and my brother went out and we tried to get, we did the lawn mowing thing and the delivering newspapers and car washing. And we're like, no, this is cool, but it's not making enough money and there's no food. So, both me and my brother said, okay, what can we go do to actually make money and maybe there's food involved? Because you know, we were young teenage boys and we needed food. We were always hungry. So then we realized, wait a minute, waitering. So then we went waiter. So I was waitering. He was my busboy. And we just basically steamrolled it into a coffee shop on weekends, night times, afternoons, whenever we could work. Made money, and there was always food around, right? So that was the first way of getting into the hospitality trade. Yeah, it kind of culminated from there. It just kind of went up and up and up. You know, you kind of open doors as you go along. We realized there were more things to just, you know, serving coffee and a toasted sandwich. Lived in a coastal town in South Africa called Hermanus, and was kind of at the beginning of the epicenter of becoming a little gastronomic place with a five-star hotel opening. There was a lot of wineries in the areas as well, and that's how I actually got into the wine and the food and kind of that kind of culture in moving around basically from there going to Cape Town. Then in between, I did a little bit of stints in China, Seychelles, Mauritius. And in between, through all of that, I always had this mindset. And I had a very cool mentor at the beginning. And he said to me, look, in hospitality, it's not about working for the same place for 10 years, right? It's not about that. He said, how many places can you go work in 10 years? And how much can you learn from them in that 10 years to become a better person? And he explained it like being a carpenter with many tools in your tool belt. So the more tools you have, the more basically you can do as a carpenter, right? So the same applies in hospitality. The more tools you have, the more you can actually do, and the more you can actually strengthen your business as a whole. So I actually started out studying as a chef, did that for a couple of years, enjoyed it, loved it, but I really realized very quickly that I was missing the front side of, or the front of house side as well. So I did go back and forth, actually, back and forth in between front of house and kitchen. I mean, even say Charles, I'm working in a place called North Island. I was employed as the FMA manager, but when I got there, I jumped into the kitchen. I was the sous chef in the kitchen during the day. In the afternoon, I would do your wine tasting, selecting your wines for the evening, barbecue on the beach, and then basically play FMA manager in between. So you kind of have the scope and capability of being a person that can jump around with a lot of hats on. Coming to Dubai, I was, again, my brother was living here. I just sold my own business. I had my own organic deli restaurant, food market concept, sold that. He asked me, what do I want to do? I was like, no idea. So I came to visit and I stayed. So I've been here now for more, a little bit over 10 years, and also basically started off in a hotel just to get to feel what it was working, how the city works, how the dynamics of hospitality works in this city. Then quickly, you know, as any place where you go in the world, and I do this always, I make a short list of places that I want to work in. And one of them was Grosvenor House. I quickly got into Grosvenor House, worked there for a total of about 6 years, ended up the director of beverage, entertainment, and promotion, also looked after the wine program for the hotel as well. And then as life takes us, you know, through the whole journey of the pandemic and everything as well, I ended up, you know, getting to the St. Regis downtown Dubai, where I'm now a multi-property beverage manager and sommelier. So I look predominantly after things that are liquid things in the hotel. But my passion, as always, if you're a true hospitalian, you are driven by curiosity. That is your main driving force. If you are not curious, you shouldn't be in this industry. If you want a 9-to-5, sit in front of a computer and just be, you know, running through life like a machine, hospitality is not what you want to do. Because hospitality, you need to be a generalist. You need to know everything about everything and everybody. So it's a bit of it's tiring at times, but it's fun. So yeah, so that basically that's where I am at the moment. So yes, that's my journey so far in a very short nutshell. There's more to tell, but you know, we have limited time. So yeah, what to do?
I'm sure we'll cover it over the next couple of questions. But there's a point there that you made, that it is very much lifelong as well, would you say? Because you, after so many years of experience as well, feel like you've known everything, because it kind of evolves, right? Like the pandemic gave it. That would have been another set of different learnings that came.
Yeah. Look, I think the industry is ever-changing. It's one of those industries that obviously there's a lot of things that's been happening, especially in the last 2-3 years, that's been very much driving where hospitality is going now. You know, everybody is talking about AI, everybody is talking about social media, but at its core, what is hospitality? It's how you make people feel. Yeah. So I don't think the human touch will ever go away. I think what we need to focus on is really on the why and the how of you make people feel. The how is always for me key, because it's not what you do, it's how you do it. You know, you can open any bottle of wine and pour it. Anybody can do that. I can teach anybody to open a bottle of water or a bottle of wine and pour it. Go through the motions, right? But it's how you do it. How do you do the storytelling? How do you do the provenance? How do you interact with a guest? How do you get the guest to understand what you are talking about when you're talking French and they are Greek? Because this also happens in hospitality, right? We talk about all kinds of beautiful ingredients, and then you just see this like veil in front of people's faces.
Yeah.
Like the key part is, how do you get people to connect, right?
Mm.
And that's the how, firstly.
Mm.
So you need to be a very good marketeer, personal or public relations person. You need to be a very good storyteller. And I think, yes, everybody is talking about, you know, storytelling you do on social media. That's why it's always funny to me when people say, oh, but, you know, I'm very good on stories, you know, on Instagram. And then I look at the Instagram and they're just reposting everybody else's stories. I'm like, that's great storytelling. But you need to be a person that can convey a good message. So public speaking, these kind of things is very key, important. And then the why. The why, again, is it's also kind of like, it's similar to the how. How do you make people feel? Why do people want to come to your place? Why do people want to be with you? Why do they want to interact with you? What makes you more interesting than the bartender around down the road, right? What are you doing that's different, you know, with, say, a sustainability angle, or a, you know, you focus on something that's a little bit more organic, or you focus on things where you want to be more entertainment side of things. So this is for me the key part now when it comes to hospitality. And that's why things like AI is great. Social media is amazing. But it's now the time where we really need to focus on that emotional connectedness that we have with our guests and with our, you know, with our teams as well. That's where it needs to line up. We need to be more on the floor, connect with people on the floor, not just be a jacket, put it on, go like, oh, I'm manager now. It's got nothing to do with it. Nobody cares. At the end of the day, it's about how you make them feel. That's important.
Very true. Do you think that is the reason why off late there's been a lot of emphasis on experiences and people seeking experiences quite actively?
I think so, yes. Because, look, it's also where we are based. I think there's been an immense focus on the entertainment aspect of hospitality, right? I'll tell you this. When I got to Dubai, I came from I'm from South Africa. So for us, the kind of focal point when you go to a restaurant is the food and the beverage and the people. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
The entertainment side came later. But when I got to Dubai, it was the first time where I walked into a restaurant and, you know, I've always had this dream to work in a place like Buddha Bar or something, because I love that kind of concept as well.
Mm.
But when I walked in and there was so much emphasis on the entertainment aspect, right?
Mm. Mm.
That to me has been something that's been very big in Dubai.
That's
and it's just escalated in the last few years. I just think we need to be careful on the sense of creating entertainment for the sake of being just in the background. It becomes background noise, but then it's boring, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where true entertainment really takes a diner on an experiential path whereby they're experiencing something, and it needs to give them, it doesn't need to be a wow effect. It just needs to give them that, like, wait, did I see right? Or, you know, just that little bit of a distraction. It's almost like, it's what I call the butterfly moment, right? You walk in nature, you're walking along, and all of a sudden you just notice there's a beautiful butterfly. And you're like, wow, that's cool. Okay, and then you go again, and then you, oh, that's another butterfly. Beautiful. You know, that kind of just singular moments that kind of puts things into a different environment.
Yeah.
I think there is places in Dubai that really gets it right. But I think there's also a couple of places that just taking it to another degree, where it's like, it's unsustainable. You cannot sustain these restaurants. This is the problem in the long term. And I think the rest of the world, if you look at other places where they do these kind of things as well, like Las Vegas, Miami, these kind of places, they are really struggling to keep up. And they need to spend millions, right, on entertainment, marketing every year. And it just, there's no more focus on what we're really there for. When people choose restaurants, they don't choose the restaurant for their entertainment. They choose the restaurant for the food first.
Right?
Yeah. If you feel like Japanese food, you're not going to go and sit and eat Italian. Because that's what you're in the mood for, right?
That's amazing,
So let's get back, right, to what it's really all about. Let's focus on the food past first. And I think that's why things like, for instance, like Michelin and Gozilo and all these little kind of, big institutions has come to Dubai and recognized, you know, food restaurants first. If you take the top 20 food restaurants on both those lists, there's entertainment.
Yeah.
The rest is food-driven. Food concepts, local concepts. The entertainment restaurants are not even featured in the top 20. If you take the UAE top 50, I think there's one restaurant. One that has an entertainment element. The rest are all based on what the food is. So I think it's going to change again, but that's kind of what the trend's been now, which has been very interesting to see.
Which also brings me to my question, and this comes from a personal, because long back I had written a thesis around how food was such a big tool in literature to kind of communicate the struggles of the diaspora. And that's when I realized, as a process of writing that thesis, that there is so much more than what meets the eye to food. Yes. Like, it's anything but just a form of consumption. And like you just said, you have your entire life around it. Go ahead. I don't even want to ask my question. You're already wrong. Go ahead.
It's such a tough question. No, it's not a question. It's again, look, I think food is the one thing that actually truly can unite people.
Yeah.
Honestly. Because even in any situation in the world, right, wherever you are, you need to sit down and have a plate of food to sustain yourself.
Yeah.
Right? So
you
either eat to live or live to eat. Right? So it depends on what time of the day, right? Because normally in breakfast is like you eat to live, right? That's normally how people see breakfast.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a social gathering, but it's more that kind of mental mindset, right? Breakfast and lunch. But when you get to dinner, it's kind of like you live to eat, right? Then it becomes a social aspect. And I think this is where we really can make food the center point of what you want to get people to understand. Because food, right, connects you via cultures. So for me, it really is something where food and the differentiating things of culture can bring us so much more together. I come from a country where we have so many different nationalities, so many different cultures. But the moment we sit down and have a plate of food, we are the same. We're humans at the end of the day. Doesn't mean anything else. Doesn't mean skin color flies out the door. Wherever you come from, doesn't matter. It's just you're having a great plate of food together and you can talk about life right now. And if you then, in that moment, can share our cultural differences with each other to understand why we are different, why not even better, right? That's why for me, I love to try new restaurants that are very traditional, and I love to try restaurants that goes a little bit like, you know, far out, but cultural restaurants first, because that's where you learn more about people. And you could just, I love doing this. You sit in a restaurant, you go and learn. Sit on a plate of food and just watch people and see what they're doing. I did this the other day. I was in a Korean restaurant. I walked in, place was packed. I walked in, I sat down, Well, first, there were, you know, hostess, just you, sir? I'm like, yes. And she was like, really? Just you? I'm like, yes, just me. Sat down and literally ordered two dishes, and I was watching people. And that's why I realized that the food was good, because it's a Korean restaurant, and 50% of the place was filled with people that were Korean. Amazing. Mm. But then you understand that the food is right, right? Mm. So food is the common communication tool that we can utilize to get people to connect with each other, that we can learn more things about life. Because, look, I was a chef for almost 9-10 years. One of my food heroes, that if, you know, if ever somebody asked me, who would you have a table of 10, you know, who would you ever want to sit and have dinner with? And one of those people I would love to sit with is Auguste Escoffier. And he lived the early 1900s, and he was the guy that basically wrote the food Bible called La Rue Gastronomique. It's a book like this, like it's massive. And I read it at least once a year. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. I read the old version that used to do recipes, not recipe for two, recipe for four, recipes for a banquet for 150 people. So the recipe quantities are like massive. So this is pre-16 when the book was still doing that. And he was known as Le Roi de Chef, Le Chef de Le Roi. So it means the king of chefs and the chef of kings. And he used to cook for the best people in the world. And even on his deathbed, this guy wrote the food Bible. Even on his deathbed, he said, I still don't know anything about food. If a guy says that, like that, on his deathbed, then who are we to judge that, right? It means, from a cultural aspect, coming back to that, there's for us so much to learn from each other when it comes to food. And you should never say, oh, I don't want to try that. You have to try everything at least once. At least once. And if you're not sure, try the second time. You'll be very pleasantly surprised. So, yes, food is connected. I love it. I don't think there's anything in the world that makes you connect better than food.
Right, and there's so many possibilities out of it. Like there's so much. But then tell me, in that so much, where do beverages fall? What is the value of beverage in that ecosystem?
Look, in the ecosystem of, let's say, and I'm just going to talk about Dubai as an example, right? Because Dubai is a duality. Non-alcoholic food scene for me has been, it's exploded in the last few years, which I think is super amazing. It's really, really good. The beverage side of things also plays a very big role. It doesn't need to be alcoholic. This is the key part that people don't understand. Look at the boom of coffee in the last 4 or 5 years in Dubai. Yeah. Coffee is exponentially grown because it's such an amazing beverage, right? It is a beverage. Mm. Even though it's full of fiber, it's amazing. It's still a beverage. So, tea is a beverage, and it's another like black hole that you can go into, and it is an amazing thing to go down to. But then you also, you know, go down wine, go down spirits, look at the whole cocktail culture that has exploded in Dubai. There's a massive focus on beverage in the city, and I think it's been really good for the city. Because we've really needed to wake up at a stage. When I got here, Dubai was really like, on the cocktail scene, we were like 5 or 6 years behind the time. On the wine scene, we were like 10 years behind the time. It was a joke. We've grown a hell of a lot in the last few years. I think we've seen a lot of sommeliers come online, which has been very good. We've seen a lot of young sommeliers coming into the city, which is amazing. We need the fresh and the new blood to come into the city. You've seen a big growth in the bar community. You've seen the explosion of mixologists with top 50 bartenders in the world coming to Dubai. All of a sudden, we have top 50 bars in Dubai. Mimi Kikuchi is one of them, which is amazing. Have to go. There's just so much on the beverage scene as well. So, again, food connects you from a cultural standpoint, where I feel beverages can actually connect you more on a social standpoint. Because food, you need to eat, right? And you go for what you feel like or what you know. Beverage, you can actually go into an unknown spectrum. You can walk into a place and not have a clue what you feel like, right? And walk in and go, I have no idea. And then hopefully have a waiter or a sommelier or a bartender or a mixologist that's going to go, you know what? Have you ever tried a Bijou? Have you ever tried a Negroni? Have you ever tried the Saturn cocktail? Let me tell you about this cocktail. Or on the other side of the spectrum in my universe where I love to go is the wine side, you know, right? So have you tried Sauvignon Blanc? Have you tried Chenin? Have you ever had a grape called Ferment? Have you ever tried a red wine from Sicily? You know what I mean? So then again, you're opening up, and this becomes then a social conversation, which is completely different. But if you know how to do both, the food and the beverage, amazing. Yeah. Then it's pure guest experiential, and that's what it's all about. That's what hospitality is all about.
Very true. And I got your contact from a lady who is pretty much, according to me, driven a huge part of that narrative of non-alcoholism in the UAE and America. I think I told her this as well. I am a not a drinker myself. And I told her that, you know, if it truly drove change at one time to see this. I think it was October when she has her campaigns around it being the dry October. And I told her, I said, that's how I kind of felt so good, because it's true. At one point, conversations used to be around the fact whether you do have alcohol or not. And it wasn't just about, there's a very thin line. This is my personal observation. Wine tasting is a thing. And it has an entire science behind it. But people used to rarely see it for that. And that's where the craft behind it was something that I felt isn't as acknowledged. And with her, when I was speaking, this is what we were talking about, that there's an entire science behind these things that goes into it and what makes it meaningful and what has much more power to it. But people used to deduce these things to just the effect of it, you know. And I truly feel like she's managed to bring that impact out. But what do you feel the on-ground reality is?
Look, first and foremost, let's go to non-alcoholic. I think whoever in this city right now, if you in hospitality, you still tell me that non-alcoholic, why should I do that? You are sleeping in frog's pajamas every day. Sorry to say, you are lost. Season 5. Because non-alcoholic sphere is the future of beverage at the moment. Because you can have almost every single alcoholic experience that you have these days, be it cocktail, be it spirit, be it beer, and be it wine, and especially bubbly as well, you can have non-alcoholic experience. So for me as a SOM, it's been amazing in the last 3 years. I've even put a program into my own property, which I call the Gentle Bar, right? Mm-hmm. So the Gentle Bar is everything that's non-alcoholic. We've gone from 3 spirits to like 9 spirits in the space of like weeks. We're offering so many non-alcoholic beers. We're offering non-alcoholic champagne, non-alcoholic bubbly, non-alcoholic white wine, red wine, everything you can think of. We don't even when I started out in Dubai, we needed non-alcoholic drinks on the wine or on the beverage list. It was a mocktail, right? And all it was the creativity of a bartender putting the coolest juices together,
yeah,
right, in a glass, which we all can do. It's not difficult, right? my favorite, you know, your orange juice, and then you put a little bit of tonic water on top. Wow. Amazing, right? Great experience. No, I'm joking. Look, that was another time. But now we have the scope. We can play with so much. We can do so much. If you do drink alcohol, don't go drinking for quantity. Drink quality, right? Drink something that's really going to be worth your while. You have 27,000 days on this planet, right? There's 27,000 wineries in France. You do the math. If you do one bottle of wine per day for the rest of your life, you can only drink France. Here's the rest of the world. So make it count. Simple.
Yeah.
Right? That's it. So if you want to have alcohol, that's fine. But make it count. Make it quality rather than quantity. Right? Mm-hmm. Drink less, but drink better. That's what I always say. But in a 7-day week, I'll have 2 days a week, or maybe three, depending how hard the week was. And I might have alcohol, right? The other 4 nights of the week, I'm not going to have alcohol. So what do I want to drink? Do I want to drink juice of the earth, which is great? Love water. I have no problem with water. But sometimes I want to have something creative. And then if I do go to outlets, I love it when they have these creations that are done with these ingredients, because then I can go like, you know what? Let me have a non-alcoholic Negroni. Let me have an Americano non-alcoholic, a Garibaldi non-alcoholic, right? Let me have a non-alcoholic gin and tonic. Why not? You have champagne non-alcoholic on the menu? I'm going to have it. I am that guy. I would love to have it. Yeah. I don't mind paying for it as well. As long as there's the value for money ratio, I'm happiness.
Sure.
But something that we need to really, really emphasize, and I'm sorry to say this, but the restaurants that are in this top 50 restaurants, Gourmet Michelin, Michelin star guides, they don't have a very good non-alcoholic program so far. Because they focus on the food, which is great, and that's what it should be. I totally agree. But the revenue that you're losing, that you're missing out on the non-alcoholic program is so huge, right?
Yes.
In a restaurant, honestly, a freestanding restaurant, 5 to 8% return on investment over 2 years, I can leave my money in the bank, it's safer. Whatever that can make me more money or generate me more revenue, that can add value to the guest and get me more guests through the door, I'm going to try. Honestly, that's why for me, non-alcoholic scene is amazing. The non-alcoholic scene at home is even bigger. It's massive. The amount of people that I've been to, I've seen people living in villas and all these kind of places, and you visit them and they go like, oh, I'm just drinking this because this is what I can find. And you go like, wait. Let me show your website. And then you show the drinks dry and they're like, no. I'm like, yes. It's huge. But it's brilliant. It's something that, and this is where I take my hat off to Erica. It was so needed. And the time when she started was so good. And now it's just, come on, people, let's support that. Let's get more into this non-alcoholic scene, even at home. And experiment at home. You don't have to be a mixologist, please. You don't have to be an expert. There is tons of recipes out there. Try, and if you're an alcoholic drinker, try and buy the items that you can drink your alcoholic drink, but non-alcoholic at home. If you like a pina colada, then try and make a non-alcoholic pina colada. That's how you start. Mm. It was like me. I love Negroni. So what did I do? I bought everything that I could find and put my hands on that I could actually do non-alcoholic Negroni at home. Mm. And that's how the penny actually dropped. I must be honest, there was a couple of things that I actually made myself because I'm a chef. I was lucky in that regard because I couldn't find it in the market. But now we don't have an excuse. Now the market is beautiful with all the items that you can get.
I know.
Have
you over the time also noticed preferences towards, say, for example, a wine
be different from different people? Like, do different people prefer different wines? Have you noticed something like that over time?
Yes, look, wine is a very subjective and objective thing, meaning that sometimes people drink objectively, meaning they drink what everybody else is drinking, right? So if somebody's drinking Sauvignon, all of a sudden everybody's drinking Sauvignon on the table, right? Or Pinot Grigio or whatever. But then there's also subjective, meaning you drink according to what you taste or what you feel you like. For me as a sommelier, my main aim in life is to be a little bit of a disruptor. Yes, I am still in the business of trying to make money, and I still answer to an owner, and you still need to make a bit of profit somewhere, right? So I can't just, you know, put things on the wine list that I love, because, you know, I'm not going to be that successful. I'll probably be 70% successful selling everything, but there's going to be 30% where the crowd in Dubai maybe is not ready for it, or they're going to go, no. So one day we'll get there. So it's not a big issue. But there is trends. People have been drinking a lot of what they like. So be it New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc or a Pinot Grigio from Italy, or a Cabernet Sauvignon from a New World country like Australia or US. Fair enough. But what has been saving me in the last few years, and especially the last 6-7 years, people have been traveling a lot. And and wherever they've traveled, there's always been wine. You go to Europe, every country makes wine. You go to sub-Saharan Africa, they make wine. You go Australia, New Zealand, South America, they make wine, right? You go to the ancient countries, you know, like Lebanon, Georgia, Armenia, these kind of places, they all make wine. Even if you go to Russia, they make wine. If you go to China, they make wine. Almost everywhere they make, right? Anyway, so wine is something that people travel. They drink the local stuff, and then they have a great experience with everything around them. Then they come back and they go like, I went to Italy. I went to Sicily. I drank Sicilian red wine, right? So then you go like, okay, cool. So then they come to you. But I had this one. They show you a picture. And you go like, okay, cool. Don't have it on the wine list, but I can get you to what you like or what you experience. So that's helped me and I think fellow sommeliers as well. And then the second part is, I think because of people traveling a lot more, people have realized there's a crap load more out there than just a Sauvignon, a Chardonnay, a Pinot Noir, a Cabernet Sauvignon. So they become a little bit more adventurous. And I think this is where the top wine sellers in the city move towards, as they've put on a little bit more experimental wines, or also wines that you normally wouldn't associate or normally get in Dubai, and they've started offering them by the glass or by Corover, so which is actually a wine preservation system, so that they can serve these little bit maybe more expensive wines, but also a little bit maybe a bit more obscure. Right, so like for instance, a Xenomavro from Greece, which is a red grape variety. Right, 2-3 years ago, you'd never see it on the wine list, never, not even by the glass. Now, all of a sudden, you get by the glass, right? So it's changing as well. But I think it's because people have become more curious and people have realized that if you just have one wine, life is going to be super boring. It's predictable, boring. But I think also that's where people have gone also. Let's experiment. There is still a lot of people in the city or a lot of people in life that would rather stick to what they know and what they like because they're scared of paying money for something and having a bad experience. But you know what? If we keep on doing that in life, life's going to be very tough for you because then you're never going to experience something beautiful again, right? And everything is very predictable.
And which are the top 3 ones that you think everyone should take a rest of? I know it's super difficult, but
it's like, look, it's like asking a father to choose his favorite child. I think it's very difficult. Let's put it this way. Let's flip it a little bit differently.
Sure.
Let's talk food and wine. So let's say 5 red grapes, right? Would be very good with, would be a more generic when it comes to food, meaning it's a safer bet. So things like Pinot Noir, Gamay Noir, Nebbiolo, Sangiovese, Barbera, Narelli Mascalese, Zinomavro. And why I'm saying these grapes? Because these are grapes that are not massive. They're not huge grapes. They're like medium-sized wines. You can serve them room temperature, slightly chilled if you want to as well, because I think our environment in Dubai, you can have reds at a little bit cooler temperature because it's very hot. But at the same time, most of these wines have great acidity. And if you look at food, I always use the analogy of, like, you know, when you cook a piece of fish, when you cook a piece of fish, the first thing that you put over the fish is lemon. You're not looking for the lemon flavor. You're looking for the acidity. But there's a sweetness in that lemon as well. There's sugar. So you're looking for that sugar acid balance. Now, in wines, you want the same things. So when you pair food and wines, normally the red wines with a little bit higher acidity, a little bit more ripeness, meaning there's fuller fruit on a red wine, pairs tend to be, or pairs better with food overall. Chilling it, there's another factor to that, but I'm not going to go into that. Chilling it just means that by the glass, it's going to be super consumable, meaning it's going to be so easy to drink. With food, you might need to warm it up a little bit. When it comes to white grapes, similar things, sugar acid balance. So I call the sommelier's catnip grape is Riesling, right? And everybody, when the moment you say Riesling to a consumer, they go, oh my gosh, it's sweet. And you're like, no, Rieslings are not sweet. Only 2% of total Rieslings produced in the world is made sweet, meaning it tastes like a dessert wine. The 98%, that is the rest, is made dry, or it has the perception of being dry. But because of the sugar acid balance, that wine can go with almost everything. That's why people love to put Riesling with spicier foods, because of that sugar acid balance, right? So things like, for instance, Riesling, things like your cooler climate Chardonnay, your Chenin Blancs, things that are coming more from Spain at the moment, things like Cotello or Albarino, Portuguese wines. Man, we have no clue what's going on in Portugal, but Portugal is probably one of the most exciting producing countries in the world at the moment. They are making incredible white and red wines. And people just think Portugal is port. This is beyond like mind-bending. And then obviously there's also now the older world countries like Georgia and Armenia. They make incredible wines, crazy wines. I was in Armenia in October last year. It changed my viewpoint on what ancient grape growing areas are doing at the moment. And we are fast asleep. I would love to see Armenian wines in the wine lists here in Dubai, but we don't have any of them at the moment. We have wines, but literally 2 producers. So now it's not enough. We need more. We need more of these in the wine. So yes, that's why I say, if you ask me 3, no, it will take me 20 minutes to tell you what to drink. It's almost easier to ask me what not to drink.
One of the things that I've noticed is this whole growth of customer experience, especially in the tech industry right now. And I'm kind of diverging, but if you see, so I'm actually bringing it back to hospitality, wherein I believe customer experience or CX or UX or whatever you call it, kind of actually has been the bread and butter of the industry for so long. What are some of the interchangeable skill sets that you think hospitality can, that other industries can kind of learn from hospitality, commonalities between the two?
Oh, I think there is a part of this guest experience part, right, that I think other industries can learn from. I think the first thing is that we need to understand that hospitality is driven by emotional intelligence, right? And I'll explain that very quickly. My inspiration for hospitality or emotional intelligence in hospitality was my grandparents. And why? When I used to go visit my grandparents, they were the ultimate hospitalians, right? Mm-hmm. You drive up, grandmother and grandfather, they were living on a farm. So when you drive into the farm, the first thing that happens, my grandfather's standing outside waiting for you. When you climb out, the door is being opened, right? You climb out, gives you a big hug, makes you feel special, happy. You know, there's dogs running around. There's everything happening on the farm. My grandmother's already standing at the door, you know, waiting for you as well. Big, you know, hug. It was like that. It wasn't the barrage, but it was just that ultimate total user experience where you walk in and your grandmother would like, oh, you look so thin, come sit, eat, drink, you know, like, yeah, continuously making sure you're okay, you feel okay. Your grandfather was the storyteller, right, telling you about what he's been doing the whole week, where he's been, how he's been working with the community, blah, all this kind of stuff, right? And continuously food is just coming to the table, drinks are just coming to the table. You know, even at the end, you know, your grandfather's taking you on this tour, showing you things. Your grandmother's like, oh, we saw this. Look, the bird had a baby, blah, blah. Mm. And then even when you leave, your grandmother's always giving you some sort of a bag of cookies, yeah, or something to take you as a gift, you know, to take with you.
Yeah.
That, to me, is the fundamental of hospitality. That's how I see hospitality. Now, if you look at how other industries, and especially the tech industry, everybody is trying to sell you something, right? It's the ultimate salesmanship these days. Everything, yeah, is about salesmanship. But the user interaction and also the actual, almost like that white glove marketing feel, where it's that very personalized one-to-one feel, is something that is going to be the key driver, I think, going forward in the world these days. If you're just going to be, if you just feel like you're just another number, you're going to lose all business, I can tell you that. And I think if you make people have that personalized experience and coming from more of an emotional side of things, it becomes better. But then this is where AI comes in as well, because AI, if you look at where AI is going now with the whole kind of like try and become your best friend almost, manages your life for you. And I think that integration is becoming a very exciting place in the whole tech industry and also social platforms and marketing and all these kind of things. Where that kind of connectedness where you, it's going to be more emotional. It's almost like you're going to have a best friend in your pocket with, yeah, your phone. It sounds strange. But you're going to have that kind of experience more and more. And I think where the human aspect comes in, we're going to have to become more choice-driven. Unfortunately, we're going to have to make more choices in our lives. And we're going to have to make a choice of, are you going to be part of it or not? But then also, are you going to be the person that wants to have human interaction, right? Or you want to stay online? You know, there's going to be a lot of different things that's going to happen in the next few years. I think it's an exciting time to live in our industries. But when it comes to the user experiences, I think more and more we need to go back to what is true hospitality. And that can be a yardstick, right? A measurement tool for any company out there on how they treat their staff, first, staff, secondly, guests, and then shareholders comes, right? And those companies you will see become more successful. If you're chasing revenue, if you're chasing money these days, I can tell you now what happened to Boeing. It's a good example. Boeing is falling flat on its face because all they were chasing the last few years has been money. Nothing to do with humans. Zero. Absolute zero. You look right now and you go like, that makes sense, right? So it comes back. Always need to have that human interaction. Always have to have hospitality. How? What do you do to make people feel different? The why and the how? That's what it's all about.
But my last question to you.
Yes, tell me.
What is that one thing you would like to tell aspiring sommeliers of today?
It's very simple. Do not try and be the big cheese immediately. Do not try and be the boss. Do not try and be the manager. Look, as I said, in a lifetime, you have 27,000 days, 4,400 weeks, right? Take good chunk of those weeks and just learn. And go learn from the people that are the best in the trade. Go become a person that's going to become a sponge for the first 10 years of your life. Those people, I can tell you now, and I've seen it now from years of experience in this industry, those people that want to do the quick growth, they climb out of the industry because they see it's like climbing Mount Everest, because they see the mountain and they go, oh my gosh, this is big, it's too much. Or they have the other experience where they climb Mount Everest and as they just get to the next, they think it's the peak, and then as they get there, they look up and then there's Mount Everest still. So they kind of realize, because in this industry, in being a sommelier, when you know very little, you think you know a lot. But when you start learning a lot about the wine industry and about being a sommelier, you actually realize you know very, very little. And this is what I look after. Me and a partner of mine, we look after a couple of things in Dubai that people might not know. One of them, one of the biggest wine communities in Dubai, and specifically one of the biggest junior sommelier communities in the city, that's called the Flight Club. Not Fight Club, Flight, meaning a flight of wine. So that tasting of multiple glasses, and we do blind tastings, is called a flight, like a plane. So we do Flight Club. We have a educational, every Sunday morning, 10 o'clock, we taste with all the people that are, or some people that are studying DIPSET, meaning Diploma WACT, which is like the fourth level, or Advanced Sommelier, or Masters of Wine, or they want to become Master Sommeliers. We taste, we do a training school every Sunday. We do 48 Sundays a year, me and Alex, which is crazy. It's amazing. We do multiple other master classes. We train from entry level to experience to expert level. Even this morning, me and Alex, we did a quick wine tasting session with each other, where we were challenging each other. What is in the glass? Right? It's fine. It's part of who we are. We didn't drink. We were spitting, I promise. Even though it was 9 o'clock in the morning. But it's fine. Part of who we are. We challenge each other that way. So this is what we do, because we know that there's so much that you need to learn in this industry. It can become very, how can you put it? It becomes a very big mountain to climb very quickly. But my grandfather always said to me, how do you eat an elephant? And you eat an elephant bit by bit. cannot eat the whole elephant. Yeah. So need to start small. But first things, go learn and work from the people that you think are the best in the industry and go work for them. You don't have to get paid for it. They will probably pay you, right? Being nice people they are, they will probably pay for you. When you go learn from them, don't go and sit with them and taste, ask them about wine, specific wines. That's the wrong way to approach any of these sommeliers. Take the wine list, take the inventory sheet, and for the next 6 months, go count the bottles every single week. Why? You learn what you have on the wine list. You start thinking of why are these wines on the wine list. Then you can ask Big Cheese why you put this wine on the wine list. And then you can actually get to know everything about this wine farm and this estate and this wine yourself. There's no more excuse. Google is our friend.
Yeah.
Right? True. Every single informative piece of information you need on wine is online, guys. It is there.
It is right there.
When I started in the industry, you had to be book smart. You had to read a book, find the information. You had to talk to winemakers and to people to find information. It was so difficult for me at the beginning to find any information on the wine industry. But I went to go work for free at these places and spend my weekends working at these places and spend my free time reading books and speaking to people and getting inspired by sommeliers. I worked with one of the first non-drinking sommeliers in the world. Wow. He was as a sommelier.
Yeah. Right,
by smelling a wine. And he passed his certified exam. He passed it. And I got trained by this guy. Because why? Because I wanted to train in a different way. He had a French sommelier as well. A lady and a guy. And I learned 10 times more from the lady sommelier, Tatiana Mercetou. She was incredible. She still is incredible. I learned a crap load from Bashir, who was the non-drinking sommelier. The other sommelier was like, you need to learn. I was like, okay, cool. No problem, dude. Whatever. You be you. Hashtag you be you. But you got to learn from the people that you want to learn. And there's no excuse. Study everything. But also humility. Humility costs nothing. When you think you know something, you know nothing. There's a very fine line between confidence and arrogance.
Yes.
You need to know what is the difference. And as a sommelier, to become confident is more difficult than becoming arrogant. Because when you're arrogant, you think you know more, or you're the most clever guy in the room. You are not. There's always somebody that's going to be more clever than you at that moment. Might not know more than the subject. At that moment, somebody will ask you a question and you'll go like, you have no idea what they're talking about. So humility costs nothing. So that's what I would recommend to aspiring new sommeliers jumping into the trade. And don't think you're going to make it big in the first 2 years. If you are a head sommelier, if you start out as a sommelier today, as a trainee sommelier, you think you're going to be a head sommelier. If you are in a head sommelier position within 2-3 years, you are wasting your time. Because I can guarantee you in 5-6 years from now, when people actually ask you about stuff, you're going to be lost. Become bulletproof from day one. That's it.
Very
simple. And this can be applied for every trade, not just being a sommelier.
That's what every trade. Yeah.
Even when I was a chef, one of the key reasons why I climbed out of the chefing industry is because everybody wanted to be Jamie Oliver. Everyone wanted to be that chef, but they couldn't cook an egg. They could not even boil an egg. I had one chef that was a sous chef, walked up to me and said, how long does it take to boil a soft egg? And I was like, what are we doing here? So, yes. So that to me is like key.
Yeah.
So that's
it. Flavor. adaptable across industries, what you just said.
Yep, it is. It is. And it, look, it's, I live, eat, sleep, and breathe hospitality. Mm-hmm. I love food. I love wine. I love people, as you can see. I'm not scared to speak to anyone. Because there's nothing to be scared of. Even if a person treats you like crap. Look, also, the one thing I want to highlight, just one thing, it's a very, very quick thing. And I think people need to know outside hospitality. Hospitality is the most thankless job on the planet. Nobody will ever thank you. Nobody will ever give you support. The amount of people that struggles with mental health in this industry is immense. They don't know it, but it presents itself as a PTSD or a form of PTSD. You see it in people. I've seen it so many times that you have waiters that step onto a floor and they're just amazing people on the planet and they get treated like they are slaves because people think it is it's the job you go do if you can't do anything else, which is so wrong. It is so, so, so wrong.
Yes.
Muhammad Ali said it the best. He said, when I meet a person in a restaurant, I judge the person by how he treats the waiter. If he treats the waiter like crap, I'm out. If he treats the waiter with respect, I stop listening to him. And I wish everybody could apply that. It is a very tough job, guys. I would love to see any person that tells me it's easy being a waiter to come. I challenge you, come. Spend 1 week with me, and you will not tell me the same thing after that week. It is one of the toughest jobs on the planet, and it's thankless, and most of the times these people have to teach themselves or get taught on the job or on the floor, right? And it is super difficult to do, especially when you get into the five-star industry. It is not easy. It is a lot of pressure that I want to go into. But it is a very stressful job. And I think people need to appreciate the people that are out there. Common decency costs nothing. Thank you means the world to everybody. And it costs you absolutely nothing.
Nothing. Yeah. Very true.
I should have led with this, right?
Yeah. They should have come up earlier. Thank
you. Sorry. Can we start again?
Or I will just reverse this in the edit.
Yeah, sorry, my battery's dying. Let's start again.
Thank you so much, Chris. Some really valuable insights in there. Like I said, I can go on. It is so much. And I think that's exactly the nature of the industry as well that you just explained, that it has no end. It's all about curiosity. And on that note, I'm really grateful and thank you for having this conversation with me and joining me today. It's been a pleasure and it's been a wonderful learning experience for me. I'm sure it'll be for listeners as well.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate the time. I think it's not... It's very few times that a person from hospitality can actually speak on a podcast or on a platform where we can actually highlight certain things. And we need people like you with voices like you that can actually spread the word and get people to understand why we're doing what we're doing. So, no, thank you to you. I really appreciate it. And I love what you do. I've watched quite a few of your podcasts and I've listened to quite a bit. And I really appreciate what you do. It's really amazing. And yeah, just keep on going, keep pushing. It just needs to happen. So it's good. But thank you so much. Really appreciate the time.